The hypnotist report stated, quote, initially, the subject indicated an admixture of desired susceptibility to hypnosynthesis, but deep-seated resistance due to the presence of a post-hypnotic block. This block appeared to have been connected with the presence, nightmarish, of a Mrs. Krebs. The total removal of this block may pave the way for maximum results, unquote. The hypnotist reported that during the pre-trance warm-up, he examined Castillo and found little scars on his forehead, chest, stomach, and fingers. Castillo told him that the scars were the result of a car accident in the U.S., which happened when some men were chasing him while he was trying to deliver, quote, an envelope of some kind, unquote. Castillo mentioned that after the crash, he'd awakened in bandages in a hospital bed. Names which were presented to Castillo in the pre-trance interview were repeated while he was under hypnosis. He recognized the names of several individuals who were then gaining notoriety in connection with New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's JFK assassination investigation, but Castillo revealed that he knew some of the people by other names. Throughout his recollections, Castillo suffered stomach cramps, said he felt a weight on his legs, unquote, and cried out in pain a number of times. Through the manipulations of the hypnotist, he was able to recall that on many different occasions he had been taken to a factory. Mrs. Krebs and Castillo had always driven to the factory in her car, and they had always entered through the front door. Castillo could not remember the exact location of the factory, other than that it was located, quote, way outside Chicago, unquote. He spoke of a romantic relationship with Mrs. Krebs, but while one moment he spoke of her as nice and kind, unquote, in the next breath, he said he hated her. According to the hypnotist's report, one thing was certain. Whoever Mrs. Krebs was, she, quote, controlled the subject's activities and consciousness like a nightmare, unquote. Eliciting information from Castillo was no easy task. Over the course of many interrogations, the hypnotist discovered that Castillo could be taken to four different hypnotic levels. It appeared to the hypnotist that each level came closer to the truth. He labeled these states Zombie 1, Zombie 2, Zombie 3, and Zombie 4. Depending upon which zombie state Castillo was in, his mannerisms and identity changed. In the first state, Zombie 1, Castillo believed he was a Loriaga, and he told tales of anti-American espionage. During Zombie 2, he took on the identity of a tough-talking CIA agent in trouble. While in Zombie 3, again Castillo emerged as an agent whose cover had been blown. At this level, however, he experienced a compulsion to kill himself. On the day he was to have assassinated Marcos, Castillo responded to a program he had revealed in an earlier interrogation. He attempted suicide in his jail cell by swallowing a bottle of epoxy glue. The Zombie 4 state revealed that Castillo's true name was Manuel Angel Ramirez, a 29-year-old native of the Bronx, New York. In this state, he had no recollection of his youth except for a hazy memory of his father, who Ramirez believed was a highly placed official at the agency, unquote. As Ramirez, Castillo said that most of his life had been spent in training with or on missions for the Special Operations Group of the CIA. He remembered one training camp where he learned clandestine and martial arts. Throughout the interrogations, the theme of programmed agent, unquote, emerged. Castillo's testimony under hypnosis was that of an individual whose identity had been completely erased and reconstructed several times over. On May 30th, 1967, Castillo spontaneously went from his normal state into a zombie state. In answering Castillo's question about transfer from the hospital to jail, the hypnotist unknowingly said, quote, that depends entirely on the big chief, you know, unquote. Upon hearing these words, a blank look came over Castillo's eyes, and all efforts to wake him were at first unsuccessful. The hypnotist then called out a series of phrases from Castillo's notebooks and found that the phrases, I will win if I don't lose my nerve, and quote, I must believe myself or no one else will believe me, unquote, awakened him. And Iptuck will continue.
The next day was Castillo's birthday. The NBI planned to give him a birthday party as an excuse to get him drunk to see if his behavior changed. Castillo, it seemed, had a huge capacity for liquor. Drunk to the eyeballs, he saluted one of the NBI agents and called him Colonel. "Where do we fly tonight, Colonel?" he asked. The agent quickly told him that he was to fly the same mission as the last one. Castillo said, "Haiphong," then drunkenly fell into bed. By the way, Haiphong, of course, is the Haiphong harbor area in North Vietnam. Castillo said, "Haiphong," then drunkenly fell into bed. He dug his fingers into his throat and vomited. He cried out for a doctor and, between vomit spasms, rattled out his mission to the hypnotist. He said his real name was Manuel Angel Ramirez, his rank was sergeant, and he was assigned to the Strategic Air Tactical Command in South Vietnam. He said his immediate superior was Colonel Summers. He was in Saigon in January 1966, he related, and had flown B-26 missions over Haiphong and Hanoi. He came to Manila, he said, to kill President Marcos in June, when the president would make a public speech. If his assassination attempt failed, someone else would get Marcos before the end of 1968, Castillo added. "I'm dying," he groaned and pleaded again for a doctor. He thought he was dying from a heart attack. "If I die today," he warned, "my secrets die with me." When the NBI doctor arrived, he examined Castillo and pronounced him fit, except for his obviously drunken state. He tried to give him a shot to calm him down, but Castillo protested violently. The doctor then asked him to take a pill, which he did without resistance. 2 days later, Castillo was given another medical examination by Dr. Alexis Guerrero of the NBI. A series of tests were given to measure his breathing rate, pulse rate, sweat production, and other functions. All of these tests were performed in zombie states 1, 2, and 3. The doctor noted that in each state there was a vast difference in pulse rate and assumed, because of what Castillo said and the reactions of his heart and respiration, that he was experiencing some emotional agitation. Sodium amytal was administered while he was in the zombie 3 state. According to the hypnotist, Castillo did not even notice he'd been given the injection. Soon he began to talk as he'd done previously while in the drunken state. "I'm Sergeant Manuel Ramirez of the Tactical Air Command," he said. When asked to reveal his base, he said, "You'll never know," adding, "I'm a pilot. I've flown a B-26. "The NBI are suckers," he said a little while later. "They thought they arrested me, but there I was, waiting for them to get me. I know of a great plot. I am supposed to expose it after I'm arrested. I know I will eventually return to my country." And in parentheses, the author has put the U.S. "I'll go through the motions of a trial, conviction, and jail as a criminal. After a couple of months, I will be released for my next assignment." Awakened from the zombie state, Castillo was told all about these various states and his strange behavior while in them. The hypnotist explained how he thought Castillo had been programmed. Castillo seemed baffled by this news. He said that he was not told by anybody about being programmed. He said that, quote, "Papa didn't even know about the zombie state." He grew agitated, saying that if he were in the zombie state, he might even kill Papa. And then, quote, "the agency would go to blazes. Hell will break loose on the guy responsible for the zombie," unquote. Asked in a trance to identify Papa, Castillo said that he was not just a guy, but was his real father. He described him as having a mustache and smoking a pipe. He said he was the only one who could send the agency to, quote, blazes if he, Castillo, was killed on this mission. He said that Papa's initials were A.D., and that his first name was Alan. He said that he would personally tell Papa about the zombie when he got back. Well, before Dave continues, we should just state in that whether the what Castillo said was true or whether it was something that he was led to believe or not, the Papa that seems to be being identified here is fairly obviously meant to be, if it is not actually, Alan Dulles, who was, of course, the head of the CIA at that time. Of course, the initials A.D., the first name Alan, and the pipe, the mustache, the whole thing, obviously is Alan Dulles. Whether that really was him or whether this was something that Castillo was conditioned to say, well, we can discuss some of these different possibilities later on.
Okay, before continuing, you listen to KFJC Los Altos Hills. Okay, continuing now with the narrative of Castillo Ramirez, or whatever his name was, this very interesting hypno-programmed assassin. After more than 40 hypnotic sessions lasting from 1 to 5 hours each, covering the period from April 3rd to June 25th, 1967, the hypnotist reviewed the data and summarized it for the chief of the Defense Intelligence Division of the National Bureau of Investigation. The summary report not only involved Castillo in the assassination of John Kennedy, it disclosed that Castillo was a hypno-programmed zombie who would kill on cue. The summary report stated, quote, "The zombie phenomenon referred to here is a somnambulistic behavior displayed by the subject in a conditioned response to a series of words, phrases, and statements apparently unknown to the subject during his normal waking state. While under the influence of such a zombie state, the subject closed his eyes, rose bodily, walked, triggered a pistol, stared blankly, and fell to the floor with no apparent sense of physical pain. As far as could be determined experimentally, the zombie behavior had for its objective the assassination of President Ferdinand Marcos of the Republic of the Philippines," unquote. The report also stated, quote, "Neither the presence nor the discovery of the zombie states in our subject should be regarded as noble or unique. If anything, the only remarkable character of the zombie state in our subject is its deeply ingrained and systematic presentation, indicating a certain disturbing degree of conditioning." Note that phrase, a disturbing degree of conditioning. In a lengthy summary, the NBI hypnotist and deprogrammer of Castillo recounted the details of exactly how he had uncovered the key that unlocked the programmed assassin's mind. The letters XBGUMIDUTYBX were found scribbled on the white surface of a cigarette package which was in Castillo's possession at the time of his arrest. The paper had been folded carefully and tucked into the back of his watch. Castillo had told investigators that this piece of paper was given him by a man named Luis Mauricio. Castillo said that Mauricio also gave him money. Mauricio was known to the NBI as a member of the Huck Guerrillas. Placing Castillo in a trance, the hypnotist called out the series of letters on the cigarette package. Castillo did not react. He then tried calling out the letters, pausing at different places. He found that when he paused between the G and the U, saying XBG, comma, a pause, UMIDUTYBX, Castillo would reply with, "I am myself to kill," unquote. The hypnotist then tried the letters one at a time, and then in different combinations. While many of the combinations produced no response, the following were significant. When the hypnotist said X, unquote, Castillo quickly answered Mauricio, unquote. When the hypnotist said BGU, Castillo slowly said, "I am myself," unquote. When the hypnotist said MI, Castillo answered, "To kill," unquote. In another session, the hypnotist experimented with saying Luis Castillo as a command. The hypnotist reported, quote, "A pathetic sight takes place after this. The subject turns his pistol to his own temple and squeezes the trigger as many times as his name is repeated." Whenever the hypnotist would say, quote, "June 12, 1967, 12 o'clock, June 22, 1967, July 4, 1967, or January 1, 1968, Castillo would invariably aim the pistol and squeeze the trigger. The hypnotist found that after the preparatory command to put him in a trace, if Castillo's eyes were open and he saw a photograph of President Marcos, he would, with no verbal instructions, aim and repeatedly squeeze the trigger of his pistol, following the photo wherever it was taken around the room. If the hypnotist said the word kill while Castillo was following this program, he would drop heavily to the floor and remain motionless. The hypnotist's report also includes Castillo's amazing story about his participation in yet another organized assassination attempt. Under hypnosis, Castillo said that the assassination had happened before noon, unquote. He remembered being with a man called Lake, unquote, whom he described as a tall man weighing about 190 pounds, with a hawk-like nose, black hair, and oriental eyes set in a long face. Lake spoke with a foreign accent which Castillo could not identify. He said that he remembered meeting Lake along with 4 or 5 other men in an airport. They then drove together in a black car to a building. Castillo said that he thought the group included both Americans and foreigners, and he thought one man was Spanish.
Continuing. When the group arrived at the building, Castillo said they climbed to a second floor room, which he described after some uncertainty as brown. The room contained packing crates, a short brown table, a typewriter, and two, quote, lift-up glass windows overlooking a street. Lake opened a black suitcase, which Castillo described as a bowling bag with a zipper and lock. It contained a scope and pieces of a rifle, which Lake assembled. He set the scope at 500 yards and gave the rifle to Castillo. Castillo did not seem certain about the make or caliber of the rifle, but finally said that he thought it was Russian. Lake told him to shoot a man in the back seat of an open car in the middle of the caravan. He said that the man would be seated with a lady or another man. A mirror was to be flashed twice from a building across the street, so that Castillo would know when he was to shoot. When he saw the two flashes, he was supposed to shoot at the next car coming into view. When he was questioned about the identity of the man riding in the open car, Castillo said that he did not know who the victim was. After Lake had assembled the rifle and had given Castillo his instructions, he went downstairs. Later, Lake rushed into the room. Quote, "They got him already," Lake told him. "Let's get out of here." He then grabbed the rifle away from Castillo, dismantled it and stuffed it and the scope into the black bag. Castillo and Lake rushed downstairs, got into a car with two other men, and drove away from the building. They picked up a bald-headed, skinny man after they turned the first corner. Three or four blocks later, the car stopped and picked up another man. Castillo said he was riding in the back seat between Lake and the man who had joined them at the second stop. As the car drove away from the scene of the crime, the unidentified man gave Castillo an injection while he wasn't looking. He went immediately to sleep and woke up in a Chicago hotel room with Mrs. Krepps. He and Mrs. Krepps got into a blue car and drove to Milwaukee, Castillo said. While driving there, they heard the news of the assassination of John F. Kennedy on the car radio. Within a few days, after the hypnotist submitted his final report, Castillo was out of the NBI jail and had left the Philippines for parts unknown. It was later uncovered that Castillo was returned to the United States in 1967 and questioned by the FBI, whose spokesman said, quote, "We talked to Castillo and he told us that he'd fabricated his story about the Kennedy assassination, said he'd made it up in Manila." The official record says that Castillo was sentenced to 6 years in the Missouri Penitentiary for robbery in June 1971. On August 1, 1974, he was released after serving 37 months. Castillo's last known contact was with his mother shortly after his release from prison. Since then, he has disappeared from both his family and those researchers who would like to question him further. If Castillo had indeed made it up in Manila, as the FBI spokesman claimed, then he would have had to have had a phenomenal memory, an incredibly high tolerance to sodium amytal and alcohol, and virtuoso acting ability. Neither the psychological profile nor the life history of Luis Angel Castillo supports the conclusion that he possessed any of these talents. Okay, that's the end of Bauert's chapter on Luis Castillo.
There are a lot of things that we ought to mention here, reviewing a few things. First of all, it's interesting to note that Castillo referred to Papa and Alan Dulles and hinted at an identity which certainly sounds curiously like that of Alan Dulles. Of course, Alan Dulles was director of the Central Intelligence Agency until the Bay of Pigs, and of course, Castillo's background seems to intersect with the Cuban situation quite heavily. Of course, Alan Dulles was also on the Warren Commission. It's interesting that Castillo would have introduced this AD figure. Remember that Castillo had scars on his arms, chest, and stomach. Now, that recalls, at least in some ways, Mr. Pettit, who had all kinds of scars. And, of course, he was involved in a plane crash. But recall that we don't know what the nature of those scars were. Were they in any way related to surgical implants? I recall the RHICEDOM technology. It's worth noting that Castillo seems to have had a penchant for suicide. First of all, the Central Intelligence Agency's assassination programs, their attempts to get someone to commit assassinations against their will, frequently involved having the mind control assassin commit suicide afterwards so he would not be available to spill the beans, so to speak. Now recall that Castillo attempted to swallow a tube of epoxy, and also then apparently a number of different combinations of those letters on the cigarette package would get him to kill himself. And It's also worth noting, too, that the frightening degree of conditioning, again, look at how complex this situation is. Four different zombie identities, which not only gave different information, but apparently responded in different physiological terms. Now, this, again, the Castillo incident occurred in 1967, and, as I said, the mind control technology was fully operational by then, and apparently, at least according to William Stevenson, it dates back to World War II, and that the almost unbelievable degree of sophistication in the conditioning of Castillo certainly lends credence to the notion that there is that degree of conditioning. So keep all of these things in mind, and as a final little comment here on mind control, we're going to read you a couple of pages, again, from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert. And this concerns an interview with a U.S. government assassin. Now, Bowert does not name this person. The interview was arranged by a chemist. This person apparently had served in the U.S. military for quite some time. And he had the patriotic assassin, as Bowert calls him, had extensive experience with mind control. And Niptuck and I are going to read you a couple of pages here, sort of as a final comment on mind control assassination for this program. What do you know, again, this is Bowert talking to the assassin. What do you know about the military or the intelligence agency's use of pain drug hypnosis, I asked. They used several different things. I've seen, actually seen, guys coming back with blanks only in certain places of their memory. Let's say that I know positively, not by hearsay, that it's done. You've seen it, I asked. You'll never get me to admit it, he grinned. Well, how is it done, I asked. They use hypnosis and hypnotic drugs. They also use electronic manipulation of the brain. They use ultrasonics, which will boil your brain. When they use hypnosis, they'll at the same time be using a set of earphones which repeat, "You do not know this or that," over and over. They turn on the sonics at the same time, and the electrical patterns which give you memory are scrambled. Again, that recalls EDOM. You can't hear the ultrasonics and you can't feel it unless they leave it on. Then it boils your gray matter. Unless the assassin had done the same research I had, he could only have known this through first-hand experience. The CIA documents released in 1976 revealed that ultrasonic research was undertaken for a period of more than 20 years. But the document said that the research had stopped, so I asked him about that. Yeah, the research has stopped. They've gone operational. It ain't research anymore. They know how to do it, he said. Do you mean that it is your opinion that it hasn't stopped, or do you mean that you know it hasn't stopped? I mean, I know it hasn't stopped, he said. For example, suppose that a dictator in some South American country is setting up some real problems and we try to kick him out. We call in some of my former group and say, look, the bastard has got to have a fatal accident and it's got to look good, like he fell on a bar of soap and broke his neck in the bathtub or something. So we go down there and get the job done. But it could be quite embarrassing if any of the guys were cross-examined about where they'd been and what they'd done. So the guys who were in on the job suddenly have a cold or something, and then they are put in a hospital for maybe just a routine checkup. They come out of the hospital in about 15 days. They're alive, they're well, they're healthy, and they're happy too. Lots of luck if you question them. They don't remember anything. That's one way it's used. The other way is to use it to improve memory, say with couriers. You want a secret message carried outside the chain of command. There's no need to have it carried by a person if it's a legal message, because the military's got 1,000 ways of sending messages which are unbreakably secret. But if it's outside the chain of command, as so many things are these days, if it's an illegal message and our Constitution doesn't permit us to do much that is legal, then you have a hypno-programmed guy carry the message. You improve his memory so that he can carry on and carry an entire coded book of what appears to be gibberish, and when he's got it down, you give him amnesia and seal off that message by a post-hypnotic code word and whammo. You got a real good secret courier, because he can be tortured to death, but he can't remember unless the proper cue is uttered. Then, if the courier is going to operate against the enemy, who might have the techniques of hypnosis down, you give him several layers of post-hypnotic command. Recall the four zombie states of Castillo in connection with assassination, interrupting, of course. In the first layer, he'll confess a false message. In the second layer, he'll confess another different false message. Finally, maybe on the fourth or fifth layer is the real message. Our guy, who is supposed to get the message, knows that the first three cues, say, are fake, and he gives the fourth cue, and out comes the correct message. If the courier was in enemy hands, he could be there for years before anybody will figure out where he was in all those layers. Each identity will probably be that of a real cutout, a person enough like him so that the enemy will think they've got the real guy. And Niptuck will continue at this point.
Many of the men in my unit were given assignments after which they were so persuaded that they didn't remember anything. I mean to say, they'd gone in believing that the only thing in life that meant anything to them was completing the assignment, to get it done, and when they got done with it, they couldn't remember anything about it. Could these guys have been that way without hypnosis, I asked? Well, they could have believed that their mission in life was that particular assignment. They usually had no family affiliations, no friends, nothing but their careers. But I don't think they'd have forgotten about those kind of assignments. Not without a little help, let us say. What was the conditioning that these guys had? Was it drugs, hypnosis, or something else? I wanted to know. Hypnosis, electrotherapy, programming them by tapes, by voice-over earphones, awake or in trance or asleep, by a number of methods. How widespread was this mind control? I asked. Well, that is something I can't really answer. I know of several different groups upon whom it was used. I know that it was used in some of the hairier areas of Korea and Vietnam, and it was started in World War II, but it has been refined far more since then. How much of it was used, I don't know. I know of several groups that I was affiliated with that had it used on them. Would you say this kind of thing did not exist before World War II? I asked. Oh, it did, but it was not in such a sophisticated form. It's as old as man, but now it's refined to an art. Before it was torture and psychological pressure. That can accomplish a lot. We've been trained to use it in primitive field situations. But now it's done with the idea that the mind can be put under complete control, just like they used to use rubber hoses at the police stations. They don't do that anymore. Well, rubber hoses still work, but they don't work as well as some of the other things which the police now have. Are you saying that the police also use mind control? I asked. At the highest levels, yes. The FBI certainly uses it, and they, of course, give a lot of help to the local police. There are certain areas of the brain which control your inhibitions. When they control those centers, then the subject will go on with his assignment, regardless. I've seen men whose mother could be sitting there having coffee, and if they'd been instructed to kill her, they'd walk right in and shoot her, and it wouldn't even upset their appetites for supper. They were conditioned to do it in such a way that they have no guilt. They wouldn't have guilt because after they were through, they wouldn't even remember it.
Okay, well, again, notice the degree of coincidence between the patriotic assassin and some of the information that we presented in connection not only with the audiovisual desensitization of Mr. Narut's assassins, as well as Mr. Castillo. Note, of course, the patriotic assassin, again, he was an actual U.S. government assassin. Note his discussion concerning the couriers and how the extent to which couriers are given several different false identities, most of which are designed to give false information. Now, in connection with Castillo, we don't know how much of what he said was true and how much was false, but it certainly is reminiscent of the Castillo situation. And note also that the patriotic assassin claims that the police and FBI are using mind control. This is something that we don't have a whole lot of information on from other contexts, but it's worth noting here. And also, as we said, the technology that we're using now, that we've been describing, the RHICEDOM, is quite primitive. Now, ultrasonics were mentioned by the patriotic assassin as one way of dissolving memory and doing certain things. That, of course, is consistent with the EDOM and the device that the little generator transmitter that we heard that was talked about, although that was electrical, this is ultrasonic. And perhaps most importantly of all, keep in mind the statement by the patriotic assassin that the research has stopped, because they always say with the officials when questioned about mind control, they say, oh yeah, we were doing research on it, but it was unsuccessful and it stopped. Well, obviously it was not unsuccessful, and the research may have stopped, but that's only because it was so successful that it's now operational.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and then we are going to be opening up the telephones.